Welcome to Ancient and Medieval History. I'm your host, Catherine Loomis. The music you have just heard and will hear again at the end of this podcast is from Magnatune.com. The artist is Tim Rayborn and the album is Kadim. The song, Hurrian Hymn to Nikal, is listed as an ancient Near East tune. I've finally received a reply from Magnatune to use their music and hope this will help round out the podcast with a little bit of musical atmosphere each week. I highly encourage listeners to check out their page at Magnatune.com. Half of what is donated goes directly to the artists. I'm also attending an SCA event this coming weekend, and I hope to talk to one of the musicians there about using some of his medieval music. Now, on to the show! First, I must apologize for not doing the planned show this week, tripping in the Middle Ages. Unfortunately, my husband and I cannot find where we read about hallucinogens in the Middle Ages. Paul remembers our professor from our undergrad days discussing it, but we cannot find the information in any of our books, though we've also read it before. I have a medical friend looking through her library, as she may have a few bits of information. Until then, I have to put that episode on the back burner. But that's okay, for I had a moment to think about the show. It is called Ancient and Medieval History, yet the first two episodes completely bypassed ancient history. So, let me do an episode on ancient history. This week, episode 3 will focus on Hammurabi. You may have heard of the Code of Hammurabi, whether in school or reading. Even if you've never heard the name Hammurabi, you may still have a vague idea of some of his code. Yet not too much is known about the man. I'll tell you what little we do know of this ancient ruler, and then move on to his code of laws. Mesopotamia, meaning the land between the rivers, owed its name to the Greeks. The rivers in question here were the Euphrates and the Tigris, the two great inland waterways between the Nile and the Indus. The cultural area associated with Mesopotamia, in fact, extended well beyond the rivers themselves, forming a broad triangle with its base along the foothills of the northern mountains and its apex at the head of the Gulf. To the east, it was bounded by the Zagros mountain chain, while on the west, the fertile land quickly gave way to the desert that separated the crescent's two arms. Basically, this is the long way of saying Mesopotamia covered what is now modern Iraq, eastern Syria, southeastern Turkey, and southwest Iran. Mesopotamia was not so much a country, but more a region, and was actually comprised of a number of people, including the Assyrians, Babylonians, and Sumerians. Hammurabi was descended from an ancient line of nomadic desert sheiks and claimed that he could trace his ancestry back over 24 generations. Unlike the Greeks and the Romans, Hammurabi was actually lost to the world until about the 1860s, when information was first published about him. At first, it was thought that he came to power in around 2342 BC. Gradually, this moved up in years until the year of accession finally settled at about 1795 BC. While originally only the king of Babylon, Hammurabi was an excellent military strategist and eventually conquered most of Mesopotamia. At the start of his reign, Babylonia only covered about 55 miles of terrain. But at the end of his reign in 1750 BC, the Babylonians ruled over all of Sumer and most of Assyria, as well as their home country of Babylonia. While his conquest would only last for about another 200 years, at the time of his death, his nation was the most powerful of the area. Hammurabi didn't leave archaeological evidence of grand palaces and lavish artifacts, at least not that has been discovered at this point in time, but there is evidence of public works, such as building of canals. What Hammurabi is best known for was his code of laws. Discovered in 1901, the stele containing the code is an obelisk-like block of black diorite measuring just over 7 feet tall and a little over 6 feet in circumference at the base. With the exception of a large carving in relief on the upper end, it was once entirely covered with 44 columns, over 3,800 lines, of text in Old Babylonian wedge writing. The stele starts out with the following, as a message from Hammurabi to his people in way of explanation of his laws. I apologize in advance for any mispronunciations. My language skills are focused more on Western Europe, such as French, German, and Latin, with a slight dabbling in Korean because I lived there for a year. While I'd love to eventually study the truly ancient languages, I have yet to and thus have had absolutely no lessons in pronunciation of Old Babylonian. When Anu the Sublime, king of the Anunnaki, and Bel, the lord of heaven and earth, who decreed the fate of the land, assigned to Marduk, the overruling son of Ea, god of righteousness, dominion over earthly man, and made him great among the Igigi. They called Babylon by his illustrious name, made it great on earth, and founded an everlasting kingdom in it, whose foundations are laid so solidly as those of heaven and earth. Then Anu and Bel called by name me, Hammurabi, the exalted prince, who feared God to bring about the rule of righteousness in the land, to destroy the wicked and the evildoers, so that the strong should not harm the weak, so that I should rule over the black-headed people like Shamash, and enlighten the land to further the well-being of mankind. He continues on this way for the next few paragraphs, and Hammurabi basically connects himself to absolutely every god in the Babylonian pantheon. And then it concludes with, "When Marduk sent me to rule over men, to give the protection of right to the land, I did right and righteousness, and brought about the well-being of the oppressed." Okay, that's about 3 minutes of this man singing his own praises. As you could see, Hammurabi was very, very modest. These laws were usually very strict, and most crimes were punishable by death, with very few exceptions. Hammurabi's code also set the precedent for the Hebrews' eye-for-an-eye laws. In his codes, rule number 196 states that if a man put out the eye of another man, his eye shall be put out. The next rule, 197, also says, if a man break another man's bone, his bone shall be broken. Rule 229 states, if a builder build a house for someone, and does not construct it properly, and the house which he built fall in and kill its owner, then the builder shall be put to death. The next rule, Rule 230, states, if it killed the son of the owner, the son of that builder shall be put to death. This is a common theme throughout the code, and very much promotes that what is lost to one by another's hand shall also be lost to the perpetrator. While today's human rights groups would never allow such laws in America, it is very basic and a fair set of rules. There are a number of rather harsh rules, though. While crimes often have to be proven, there are a few exceptions. Rule 127 states that if the finger is pointed at a man's wife about another man, but she is not caught sleeping with the other man, she shall jump into the river for her husband. This is actually very harsh, as it says the woman is guilty no matter what. In this case, she wasn't proven guilty, so she won't be killed by the law. Instead, it is her duty to kill herself. In rules where the man and woman are found together, they are both killed in a variety of ways depending on how they are found. There are also rules that take in extenuating circumstances and are actually in favor of the woman. Rule 136 states that if anyone leave his house, run away, and then his wife go to another house, if he then return and wishes to take his wife back, because he fled from his home and ran away, the wife of this runaway shall not return to her husband. In other words, he ran out on her, she shacked up with another man, and he comes back, "Oh, I want you back, I'm sorry, you're my wife, join me in my home." And she can say no, and the law is actually on her side because he actually abandoned her. Rule 144 states, if a man take a wife, and this woman give her husband a maidservant, and she bear him children, but this man wishes to take another wife, this shall not be permitted to him, he shall not take a second wife. This rule is basically saying that a woman, or the wife, has given to her husband a maidservant. From the way it's reading, it looks like it's saying that the maidservant bore the husband children, not the wife. But because it was her maidservant that bore those children that she gave to her husband, he cannot abandon her and take on a new wife. He basically has a duty to her now. Rule 148 states that if a man take a wife and she be seized by disease, if he then desire to take a second wife, he shall not put his wife away, who has been attacked by disease, but he shall keep her in the house which he had built and support her so long as she lives. This is a wonderful law. It basically says that if the wife is so diseased that he can't be with her anymore, or she can't bear him children or whatever, he can't just abandon her or throw her out of the house. It looks like he can take another wife, but he still has to provide for the first wife. Now, on to this week's traveler's note. You can see the code of Hammurabi in the Louvre in Paris. While it is obviously worn with age, the inscriptions are in excellent condition, and the carving of Hammurabi receiving the laws from Shamash is very clear at the top. Even though I cannot read Old Babylonian, looking closely at the writing, we merely appreciate it for its even hand and historical value. In fact, the text actually looks kind of pretty. It's just so evenly etched into the stone, and it's in such great condition. The code is actually also very accessible. It's merely roped off in a small square area in a relatively large room. Also, this area is usually a lot lower in traffic, as everyone crowds and pushes to see the Mona Lisa, Nike, Winged Victory, and Venus de Milo. It seems not too many people are interested in the very ancient cultures like Mesopotamia. When we visited the Louvre, I actually didn't know the Code of Hammurabi was going to be there, but when I looked over the floor plans and saw it, my heart skipped a beat, grabbed my husband, showed him, his eyes widened, and we made a beeline immediately for the stele. One nice book we have that I used for this podcast is the Historical Atlas of Ancient Mesopotamia by Norman Bancroft Hunt. It's not a very hefty tome, weighing only in around 190 pages. It has some very nice maps to give you an idea of Mesopotamia, and gives a good overview of Mesopotamia for those who just want to peruse the history, get a brief idea of what the culture and the history is like. It also has quite a number of photos of artifacts that are actually very interesting just to view in their own right. Well, that's all for this week. I'm not quite sure what next week's topic will be, but I have a week to figure it out and prepare it. So, hopefully, I will also have time to sit down and plan out a tentative schedule for the next few episodes, so I'm a little better prepared and know ahead of time what resources I have on hand and don't have to change my mind about the topics. I hope you have enjoyed this show, and join us again next week. Remember, you can check us out on the web at www.sportel.com/ancient.html, or you can drop us a line through email at history@sportel.com. We're more than happy to hear from you. We actually just received our first email the other day, and it was very encouraging, and it made me feel very, very good, and my husband gave me a good pat on the back for that one. So thank you very much. Hope you keep in mind my personal philosophy, and one that my husband joins me in on: live to learn. Take care.